My name is Michael Petter, and I am the lecturer for this particular lecture. So, since we have quite a lot of people, and we usually terminate the whole thing with like 30 people, there might be a slight discrepancy there. So, I don't know how many of you have read like the module description or the homepage or anything of that. What I want to clarify up front is that this is not an introduction to programming. So if you're here to learn how to program, this is not the lecture for you. So from past experiences, this has been an expectation of a few people in there, and this is not what we're going to do here. Instead, what we want to focus on here is like kind of a spiritual continuation of a lecture from last semester, the compiler construction, which lays the foundation about how to translate the basic concepts of programming languages, like an imperative language, something like C. And here we're going to look at a few advanced concepts in programming languages and talk about, first of all, what the semantics of these concepts might be. So this is what we see here, semantics of these concepts. And then the second point of interest in that is, as soon as we know what this particular feature is all about, how can we hook that into an own implementation of some kind of compiler? What are the prerequisites we need? What are the means by which we can implement these things? So, yeah, for that, you would probably benefit a lot from the knowledge about how an actual compiler works. So, this is what we want to do in this course. What we need for this course is a few things. Particularly, we want to do a few examples during lecture, as well as a few assignments in the tutorial. And for that, we need some kind of skill set in order to be able to solve the tasks there. And for that, we need knowledge about, well, fluent knowledge about languages like Java, some kind of functional language. I know that there's a lot of controversy about which one is the best and all that, and I don't really care. I say that if you know one functional language, you can easily abstract away every last little bit and know in general how functional languages work. So typically functional programming and verification gives you that kind of knowledge. So CAML, Haskell, Lisp, Scheme, whatever you'd like to see here, would do fine. Then since we will also tackle the more machine-oriented parts of semantics at some point, we would like to set up a few experiments. And for these experiments, it would be very beneficial to know how to program C. Also, at some point, we are going to look at a full-fledged object-oriented system. This would be something with multiple inheritance and all that kind of nice little things. And that would be then C++ in that lecture. And, well, you'd better know about how that works. Otherwise, well, you could say another language like C# or Java does similar things, but if you look closer, it clearly does not. So, C++ would also be a good thing, particularly since we look at how the features in C++ are actually implemented in the compiler. Since we're talking about things like semantics, we will at some point look at the respective assembly instructions that correspond to certain features in high-level concepts, and therefore some idea of how assembly works is probably a good idea. And then there will be a few other aspects that are better represented in languages like Lua or JavaScript, which are not so rigidly typed as the other ones. And, well, this is code that you're also going to see in there. And, yeah, so this is all things that you're going to see on the slides or find in the tutorial. And if you feel unwell with these things, you probably should take the linked lectures before so that you somehow know a little bit background. If you have this background, well, fine. You might be the right person in here. So if I talk about certain high-level concepts we're going to see here, which is a very wide field, and you could have a whole wish list of things that we don't show here, but there are a few selected topics that we consider to be useful building blocks in programming languages, and these we are going to highlight in here. So this might comprise, for example, at the very beginning, memory models. How does what does defining semantics for a memory model actually really mean? Why is it necessary? And what does that comprise? So this will mean that we are going to talk about the usual memory models that you know from your introductory courses, and then about what the reality gives you, like a little bit more relaxed memory models. Then there's a few ideas of how to cope with this very liberal way of how memory semantics works in terms of weight-free algorithms and lock-free algorithms. And as an application of that area, we will look at how locks and monitors work, particularly in presence of memory models that are, well, a little bit more relaxed. Then we're going to go on to control flow in concurrent systems and have a look at a few concepts in there. So there is the transactional memory part, which I find that this is a good place for. And if I manage to finish the lecture in time, then I might also put a few slides on coroutines and continuations in this part. This is not directly related to concurrent systems. You could also imagine these coroutines and continuations in non-concurrent systems, but the presence of concurrent systems, this has found some new uses which might be handy. So this is kind of a newcomer in this area. So then there's the next big chapter where I will then switch over from these issues of memory semantics and concurrent systems to some different topics, particularly in this case, method dispatching. How does the machine find its way from a method call to its actual implementation? So there are several issues involved there, like with overloading and overriding and a little more, well, if you put that into extremes, then this would be like multi-methods and multiple inheritance. So these will usually be terminated either in December or first week of January, and in the new year we will then tackle modularization concepts different from inheritance. This would be things like, or well, not different from inheritance, but different from these classical single inheritance or multiple inheritance systems, which would then be this mixins and traits. And something which is a little bit, well, different to that, more focusing on delegation. This would be prototype-based languages. And in the end, we're going to sum up with metaprogramming, and this would be aspect orientation and homoiconic metaprogramming. So this is the content that I plan to do here. This might be also extended by a few talks given by essentially, well, a subset of you. Because there is the concept of, well, improving on your grade by giving a short talk on a selected topic from this area. Well, general concerns for the lecture, well, there's me, but then there's also the person for the tutorial, which is Rafaela. Welcome, Rafaela, please. So she will be giving the tutorial slot. Is there details for the timings on there? Maybe on the next slide then? Okay, so delay on that. So for lecture, you might have already realized that we didn't start at 12, but I plan to get some lunch, so this will be 12:20. We hope, if everything goes right, that we will have at least 12 lectures. That depends a little bit on sicknesses going around and whether there's more important events than programming languages. Who could think about anything? But there might be events that take away our room, and this also takes away lectures. We used to have a guest lecture for this year. I haven't found a guest lecture so far, so yay, more time for actual useful stuff. Then, there's of course the New Year's holidays from 24th to 6th of next year, and there's no holidays over there. We plan to publish the topics for the mini seminars before the actual holidays, so you get the chance to really enjoy your holidays. If you want to obtain the slides for this, you can do so freely at that URL, and a little bit of navigation following that. You can also get an instance of the recording of that lecture from this URL. Well, I still have to configure it a little bit, but it will at some point carry the lecture recordings. Then there's the ever so hot topic of the exam. And the thing that I want to highlight you here the most is that this is offered in terms of a single exam, so there will not be a re-exam. Just up front, so that you know, so that you can bail out as long as it's without a lot of effort. I'll try to make the exam assignments as close to what you're used to see as assignments during the flow of the semester, particularly with your tutorial sheets, so that if you follow the tutorial, you won't find exact versions of the exam assignments there, of course, but you get an idea of how difficult these things actually should be and get a decent preparation for that. Since it's only a single exam, and I know that you're all busy people from different contexts and all, I don't want to stress you more than necessary. So if you have any scheduling problems, particularly if there is another exam on the same day that ours is, then please contact me and we will arrange for a substitute then. So the only thing is we won't have another second exam at the beginning of summer semester like you might be used to for your basic lectures. Yeah, instead, there is then the next winter semester or alternative lectures in the next summer semester. Yes, so then this is on exercises and tutorial, which is by some weird reason a separate instance of an event. This is internal things of the management here, so I don't know why, but this other event is considered to be the tutorial for that, and this is what Rafaela does with you. So there will be exercises on these sheets.
Yes, so just as you should used to it, so there will be exercise sheet for each week. So solving the sheets is voluntary, but of course highly recommended, so there will be no grading or something. What we will do is we will discuss the exercises together in the tutorial. So this is not just that I present you the solution, so we are going to discuss it together some parts should be presented by you. It's Fridays starting at 8:30, so here in this room, Lecture Hall 2, and we will start next week, not this week, so on October 25th. And so yes, the exercise sheets are also available over the website, where you can also find the slides. That's basically it, so see you there next week. No, the exercise is not recorded.
Well, it's an interactive discussion, so I don't know whether it works as a recording so well. Well, it's like a transcript run, but that's not the way that it's intended. So you should. It's really about talking about the topics and really engaging in discussion.
Are the solutions going to be published as well?
Yes, the solutions are going to be published.
Just as a kind of recommendation, I know you're all way above 18 and you know how to do your studies, but just reading the solutions is usually not the way to pass the exam. I didn't want to do any, but I would really try to work on these things and not just check them and say, oh, I could have done that and be done with that. So really, please try to do them yourself.
There's the tutorial and all lecture slides available right now. And you said, is there a reason you don't provide them at Moodle? Like, why do I have to go to three different sites over my courses? Like, isn't it more practical to just upload it in Moodle? For you as well?
How are your experiences with Moodle?
So you're talking about the lecture
and
also the
sheets.
Exercise sheets. So I have no strong opinion to that. So I mean, I don't know. I mean, if you have a bookmark in your browser, then it's also just one click away. So
I mean, we don't use any or plan to use any of the actual additional features of Moodle there. So it's just a barrier of entering a password once more than necessary in principle.
So we can think about it, but so in the moment it's there and you will see whether it will change or not. Other questions?
So others. Yeah, there's also, I think, a script distributed through the Fachschaft, which is, well, the copy of last year's slides. If you want to use those, you can. I usually am a last-minute person in doing changes to my slides, so at some point there might be differences between this script and the current slides, but I guess this is probably a thing that applies to all the lectures that you have, so you're probably used to that if you're a script person. Concerning the lecture slides being available up front, well, I'll try my best. There is... I don't know whether we currently link to something like that, but well, there is still the possibility to just use the slides from last year and start annotating them when they're different. I can also, if they're not there yet, I might then add them as soon as I find a free minute in this first week. Well, at some point I will probably add them for sure. However, the same applies as for the actual script. There might be differences from the script to the actual things because I like to do my changes 1 hour before the lecture. So, yeah, that's around that. Then the bonus on the final grade. So you can earn, well, the usual .3 bonus on the final exam by preparing a short talk, like 15 minutes talk on a selected topic in the general area, and we will provide you with the topics at around half of the semester. So yeah, that is what we usually do in this and in compiler construction. So around December we will announce these topics, and you will get the chance to present them in February. So this is all that I have prepared for announcement stuff today. If there is still a question on that, yes?
Will there be a tutorial session on this Friday?
No, there will not be. A tutorial session starts Friday next week.
Yes, please. Is it necessary to have listened to compiler construction?
I'm sure you can still do without if you have enough patience to read about backgrounds if they arise, and if you have enough programming experience so that you can read what we find there. This will somewhat, well, you will have to work a little bit more then, I guess, but I think it's doable.
So it doesn't heavily rely on the lecture?
It doesn't directly pick up from the formulas in there or from the definitions in there, but I might talk about concepts from there, and up to a certain degree I'm willing to explain, but if it's too deep into what actual these basic compiler construction things are, I might also say, well, that's a point where you should maybe consult a book. But yeah, I think it's possible with enough work, should be doable. Since I have known both topics for so long now, I'm probably a bad person to ask whether that works or not. So, any other?
Is there already a date for the exam?
Yes, there is. My birthday. No, it's 12th of February. Still my birthday. Any other? Yes? I think the official rules say that you have to pass first before this thing is applied. Yeah. So that's nothing that we can change. Good. Just before we finally go, I'm usually interested in my target group. So I don't know. What have you people studied so far? I know that there's, of course, my home community, like the computer scientists around. So is there a few of them here? Okay. So what are the other people? Maybe games engineers? So that is my usual crowd, computer scientists and games engineers. But who's the rest? No idea what you study? Yeah? Okay. So how many of technology and management do we have here? Oh, okay. Quite a lot. So anyone here who's not of these three groups? Okay, good. So just informative things for me to know about what I can really use and what I have to explain and all that. So let's start with the first topic, which is on memory consistency, semantics of memory accesses, and all that revolves around that. So for you to kind of, well, get an intuition of why we are talking about something like this at all, maybe a short example. So consider these two short programs. They're really not so difficult to understand. So there's one thread that just assigns values to variables. Let's assume that they have been zero before, and just assigns one first to variable A, then to variable B. Then we get another thread, and this thread executes first a loop that reads from variable B, tests for the thing being equal to zero, so tests for the variable still being in its initial state, and as long as variable B is in its initial state, it loops. As soon as the variable is not initialized anymore, but assigned by something different, the guard of the loop fails and falls through to the next instruction, which is in that case just an assert, or, well, maybe an if instruction, if you want to see it like that. So, and you have been taught programming in Computer Science 1, maybe, and there is the understanding of a machine that would execute these things, and if there's threads, the machine then switches from one thread to the other. At some point, one thread executes its things. For example, the thread B is scheduled first, starts executing, and runs its loop, and the guard never lets through. So at some point, the whole thing is descheduled. Thread A will run. A and B are assigned new values, and since this thread is terminated, this doesn't interest us anymore. At some point, thread B is rescheduled and will resume work. At that point, it will realize, well, variable B is assigned 1 now, so the guard fails, and we fall through to the assertion, where we will assert, well, if everything goes fine as long as A is 1, and since we have assigned A value 1 as well, everything is fine. So this is kind of the intuition that you get when you finish with Introduction to Computer Science 1 and its practical course, and then you start entering the real world and start writing programs like that, and at some point you get highly paid contract to implement exactly this algorithm and have the need for A being 1 at the end, and realize, well, in my tests, well, 99% of the time the test goes through. However, there's cases where this test actually doesn't hold, and instead I get my assertion thrown around the system. So what happened there? So it turns out that in real systems, not in all, but in some of them, if you try this program often enough, that at some point the assertion might actually really fail. And you begin doubting your skills as a programmer when that is the case. So, however, that's not because you've done anything particularly wrong. It's just a thing that so far things like memory model have not been like your center of attention at that point. So this is exactly where the definition of how the memory model actually really works kicks in. So the assertion in thread B failing is actually, on some systems, allowed behavior that depends on what hardware is in there, what guarantees your compiler has, and so on. So, what's behind that? So, well, as I've already said, there's a few factors that you have to look at. Of course, there need to be some concurrent threads for a thread-based program to really work. Then in actual systems, the world is not as black and white as it has been in your Introduction to Computer Science, where you have one large block of memory which you can access to your liking. In practical systems, you usually have your data replicated in hierarchical or even distributed memory systems that have very complicated structures of communication. There's small areas of very fast memory that usually take a working set of variables that are usually accessed quite frequently in your program and keep them available with very short access times. And then there's the hierarchy continues down to very slow main memory that can contain a lot more data than these small scratch pads of cache that you usually have, but are like a factor of 100 slower than your highest level memory. So this is, since a lot of years now, the state of our general purpose computers. It's hierarchical. We have a hierarchical memory system in there with several levels of caches that that keep data in different access times available, and well, it all works in the background without giving you much insight of what actually works there. But there is some complex algorithms going on in there. So this is what memory really looks like. And after a few years of having these hierarchical systems, the engineers that do them have had realized that keeping these systems in a state that you don't realize that they're actually there is quite an effort to do, and you could deliver information a lot quicker if you wouldn't have to hide all these complex details of this memory hierarchy from the user. So there's ideas, aren't there, to at some points drop the disguise of having one uniform memory, but several hierarchical memory systems now, allowing for the engineers to make optimizations in these systems. And these usually mean that the communication that is necessary in order to establish a convenient state is deferred now a little bit, with drawback of having a few a little bit unexpected behaviors. And one of them is the one that you have seen on the slides before. So memory models are now there, or definitions of memory models are now there, in order to restrict the freedom of implementation of these hierarchical memory systems, such that you can have certain runtime guarantees, particularly that the data that you store in these systems remains in a consistent state, whatever consistent means. And the other part of this negotiation is the actual establishment of a certain degree of freedom of implementation in order for the hardware engineer to actually enable certain machine model optimizations such that the overall performance is a lot better than in these strictly transparent systems. Also, compilers might rearrange your memory access a little bit in order to get a little bit of performance out of there at the cost of at the cost of the integrity of your data. So in the modern languages where you have these kinds of memory systems, you usually have the need for a definition of such a memory model in your maybe even in your memory in your language definition, but also of course on the hardware definition. And the compiler is there to ensure that what the language guarantees you as your memory specification is correctly matched on what the hardware provides as memory semantics. And yeah, so that's an actual issue in compiler construction. People have historically neglected that part of language and machine definitions for as long as there have not been such complicated systems, which is a thing that you can, for example, see in the development of C and C++ language standards, where just the recent definitions of C and C++ from the 2000 10 and up generations actually have some kind of memory specification. Don't nail me down on this. It might be a little bit earlier, but around 2010 was the point where people started to integrate some kind of memory specification into the actual language definition. Before that, in ANSI C89 or something like that, you would not have anything like that, and implementation would be free to do as it liked, and there have been a lot of undefined behaviors due to that. So let's dive deeper into this matter. So if you come from your introductory courses and have heard about how machines execute code there, you have probably a quite intuitive understanding of how you would expect a machine to actually interpret the code that you have given to it. And usually this means that you will intuitively have an understanding pretty close to what strict consistency models would be. So this is the first kind of model that we want to see here. This is kind of the ideal thing that you would expect a machine to work like. But yeah, let's see how that boils down. So in sequential computing, you would say that usually as soon as you execute a particular instruction, its effects are written down to the machine and are valid from that point on, and there's no doubt about that. So your intuition would probably be to transfer this idea to concurrent computation also. So if at some point in time a particular access happens, it happened and is valid for the complete world, particularly for all the other CPUs out there, which are also doing accesses. So this is what we would call strict consistency. So to maybe do this definition here. Independently of which process reads or writes, the values of the most recent write, recent in terms of actual timing, to a particular location is observable by all the reads from that particular location immediately after this thing has this write has terminated. So this just means that as soon as you write something to memory, it can be read from anywhere else. So this would be the ideal world, wouldn't it? This is already on kind of physical level a thing that is very difficult to realize, particularly since there's things like, well, you would have to establish or agree on an absolute global time, which is in itself already quite a problem, since there are signals between circuits have a certain running time. So, yeah, well, I don't know how to do that in circuits, but yeah, this is what you would need for strict consistency. So, yeah, that's physically not possible in that sense. So this is quite a strong assumption to make for practical systems. So what would be a more appropriate way of talking about what semantics of concurrent accesses to memory would be? So this would mean that since a global shared clock is a thing of illusion, you would probably do away with that and instead talk about a thing that we call well, we don't call it here, so let's not mention it right now. So we're going to get rid of this notion of absolute time. So let's maybe observe a little bit our initial program and what happened there, and maybe we come to a solution for that. So we've said the initial state of A and B is clear for us. This is zero. This is established before our thing runs. So this is outside of our time constraints here. Then we say that A writes A before it writes B. So there is a certain timing relation between those two instructions there. So this is a notion that should be respected by our new view on time. Then B there will, before the assert is actually really evaluated, it will see that B turned from zero to something else, usually one. But what is there is that there's also a certain relation between those in terms of timing. So the assert will only start as soon as the value of lowercase b turns 1. And, well, the last thing was given by the algorithm, assert should always hold. So in order for the assert to actually really hold and the program or the this program to be correct in terms of the assert never failing, would mean that this only works when writing this updated value 1 into A actually really happens before A is what? Reading a 1 in B before before the B can be read from this location B in that sense. So there's still several actual real executions that might match this description of this writing 1 to A happened before reading 1 from B. And you see them kind of sketched in these little diagrams where you have thread A and B, like foo and bar over here, and the shared memory here. And this happens before relation here would mean that this A is assigned 1, happens at a certain point in time, and reading A from B only happens after this A has gone to A. So this is, for example, happening here. So here you see thread B going from querying B to querying A. This means that the thread B has left the loop and gone to the next instruction. And this only happens when B can be read from 1, and this would be this instance here. The first execution, for example, does not even reach the point where B is set to 1, so the loop in B remains in its looping state. And yeah, the last one is also one where thread B or bar observes that B has changed its value and then starts evaluating A. And this also is a state where A is set to 1 before this actually happens. So this now is all based on one particular observation described by this happens before relation. So this is kind of the basic mechanism that we now use to replace what has been an actual global timer before, which would be a happened before relation. And yeah, this is what we establish now in programs. And in order to do so, we need to talk about these kinds of systems that we have already seen sketched on the slide before. So more generally speaking, what we have used there is a diagram for distributed systems of processes. These processes have names, and there are certain events occurring in these systems that are enumerated on these systems, and you draw these events on the so-called process line. And if on such a process line you find two events, for example, on process P's process line, events P1 and P2, if P1 is more to the left of P2, then P1 has happened before P2, and conveniently we number these events in the order in which they happen. So P1 is before P2, before P3, P4, and so on. So there, on each of these lines, already there is happened before relation, like P1 is happening before P2, P2 happening before P3, and P3 happening before P4. So this is the events that occur for a particular process in isolation. If you now... Oh, sorry, yeah?
Yeah, so this illustration basically suggests that the events are atomic operation, right? So
yes.
Like a point. Okay, but is that... Can you really say that? Because in the end, you can always split up, okay, the RAM...
That depends.
...several steps to access the memory cell and so on.
That depends on what you consider to be an event and the access of a memory cell. You could represent as, well, we have the beginning of the update and the end of the update as events, so to say. And
we'll probably
these
want
are in that sense.
Find an event as something which cannot be parallelized. So, because as soon as you... Parallelizable again, you have the concurrency issues.
Well, at some point you might be even interested in parallelization of these things in order to do things in parallel.
But then this should flow into the I'm just curious, like, what are these events? Is it like really access to the RAM, or is it just something a lot more high level?
We will instantiate these diagrams, for example, when we access particular variables, and we will model these variables in different granularity, like, for example, as their representations on the cache line. And for our purposes, the access of one particular cell is in for itself.
It's singular, not parallelizable.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's that. So, yeah, there's several processes, each of them represented with a line. For each of these lines, there we have established a particular happened before relation implicitly by, well, these events being separate from each other on the line. Then there is the possibility of dependencies of one event from another, and this might not necessarily only be a dependency due to intra-process things, but also one particular event might be depending on an event at another process. So there is inter-process dependencies in there. And these are the ones that you see sketched here with these dotted arrows. These are dependencies that come from particular communications between two modeled actors in this system. And if we have such a dependency, this means that the happened before relation now also is valid between this P1 and Q2 in that sense. So this you can consider like a message between those two processes. We will see how messages are handled in our systems. So, in terms of formulating these things, we introduce a particular formalism for that. It's red arrow, and this means that P happened before Q when this is established. And as an observation for that, we see that, well, for once, this relation is a partial relation. So this means that it's not necessary for two events to be in relation at all. There's events between whom there's no happened before relation at all, meaning there's neither P happens before Q or Q happens before P. So these pairs of different events exist. Also, happened before relation is irreflexive, so it doesn't hold to itself. Well, it's probably pretty clear. You can't happen before yourself, so this doesn't make any sense. the happen before relation is transitive. So if P happens before Q and Q happens before R, then P also happens before R. So that's transitivity. And it's also asymmetric. So if P happens before Q, then Q cannot happen before P. And all in all, this means that the happened before relation is a strict partial order. So now, what does concurrency mean in these settings? We consider two distinct events, P and Q, concurrent if they are, well, if P neither happened before Q and or Q happened before P. So, yeah, if there is no relation between them at all. So, as an example, in our diagram here, we can have a look at this thing here. So here is claimed that P happened before R4. P1 happened before R4. So this is not a trivial thing, since these are events from different process lines. We find P1 over here and R4 over here. So how are they... are they actually happening before each other? Well, we need to construct a chain of happen before relations between them in order to verify that, and well, can try to do so. So there is this happen before relation that gives us P1 happen before Q2. Then there is the implicit happening before, so Q2 happened before Q3. Q3 happened before Q4, that are given due to the local ordering in this process line. Then we could continue this line, but it's by outside knowledge we know that this is the one that we have to focus on. So there's a happened before relation between Q4 and R3, and one before now the implicit one between R3 and R4. So this gives us a chain of happened before relations, which we can shorten to P1 happened before R4. And so P1 and R4 are definitely not concurrent. There is a relation between them. So then there is the claim that we have parallel or concurrent events with P3 and Q3. These are there and there. And, well, there is just no chain that you can find that this happened before chain between those two. So if you go from Q3 onwards, you will reach Q4, Q5, Q6, Q7, P4, R3 and R4. So Q3 is definitely not the one that happened before P3. And in the same way, we can have a look at whatever P3 happened before, and this is in our diagram just P4. So we can't reach Q3 via that, and this means that there is no happened before between those two. So yeah, they are concurrent. So that's the way that you have to interpret that. To make life a little bit easier and non-graphical here, we have now a look at a definition that helps with these determinations of concurrency, and this would be the ordering with a logical clock. And this is now based on the idea of giving globally unique logical timestamps for each event P in the form of a natural number. And we want to see whether we can somehow correlate our ideas of concurrency to some things that have to do with numbers. So, first of all, clock condition, what is that? So, we define the clock condition as, well, a particular function from events to natural numbers, and this function can satisfy the so-called clock condition if for events P and Q, when there is a happened before between them, then the logical clock in form of a natural number is actually smaller than the logical clock value for Q. So, for distributed system, the clock condition would hold if, for example, for two events of the same process, Pi and Pj, if Pi happens before Pj, then their clock condition values also need to reflect that in terms of the timestamp for Pi needs to be smaller than the timestamp for Pj. I think this is quite intuitive. Then if P is sending a message and Q receives that, and P is a member of process uppercase P, Q is a member of process uppercase Q, then their timestamps also need to reflect that in terms of being larger than the other. So a logical clock then satisfies this clock condition. That satisfies a clock condition is a total order on all the events in there. That and this total order embeds in the actual happened before relation, in the sense that if this happened before holds between these events, then this is reflected in the in this clock function C. So we can then try to use that to define a better consistency model. So maybe before we do that, let's have an example for an actual clock, a function that serves as the clock condition for our example. So we have events for all our processes. So for the processes of P, for Q, and for R, we need timestamps, and these are given by the clock function C. So what would be an appropriate function that satisfies the clock condition? Maybe you can help me with that. Any ideas? How do I start? Okay, so the first ones, P1, Q1, and R1. What would I do with them? I need to define some kind of timestamps for those. Well, all you need to do is you need to satisfy the clock condition, meaning that they have to be in a particular greater than or smaller than relation in case that happens before holds. Like that? Is that? Just a moment. So P2, now you propose 4. So the value here has to reflect the happened before relation. So you have to look at, of course, this thing here. This is what you have said. So this needs to be larger than the value for P1. But also there's, of course, this interprocedural relation. So you need to make sure that the value you pick is also larger than the value for Q1. And, well, yeah, turns out it is for this. But that's the way that you have to proceed in this. You start from the left for each of these process diagrams. You pick a random number for those. And for the ones that are depending on the other ones, you have to make sure that they are at least one larger than all the ones that they depend off, and also that it is a unique number. There was a... The thing that you do for that is actually topological sorting, yes. So this is what you need to do on this, on the graph that is behind that. And for the whole thing to make an actual graph out of, you would have to also have the relations between these implicit things. But then you can do topological sorting, and you're done. So this is what this type of algorithm would be called when you have done your algorithms lecture. So topological sorting can be applied, which yields one instance of a function that fulfills this clock condition. And yeah, well, we can continue to do that thing here with, well, either P3. P3 here is just larger than P2, so like this. P4 then, well, there's still dependency for which we can't say now, so we won't do that.
As P3 are concurrent with Q3, there we have to be the same number.
By definition, you have globally unique timestamps. So our idea of things being concurrent doesn't mean that they have the same timestamp in that sense, because it's not a logical clock. It's not an actual real timing thing anymore. So you can't directly argue about the actual real value of these things, whether two events are to be considered concurrent or not. And this also should probably give you an intuition that the function that we have here, or the value that this function gives, is not an actual indicator for things being parallel or not. Because it's just one instance of how you could give timestamps to certain events, but that does not necessarily mean that you caught the instance that that models when these two things are actually parallel. And there is actual flexibility between those, because the dependencies just say that they can be parallel, but they are not necessarily like that. So this is maybe the motivation why there is no thing like two parallel things have the same numbers. All in all, when you continue these things, we'll see come to a maybe similar thing like I have, maybe a little bit different one. So there's several solutions to that, but what all of them have in common, that they have to satisfy clock condition, and this is a particular definition that you can inline there. Yes?
So shouldn't we have put the same number to the concurrent events, like for Q1,
Q1? Well, concurrent... Well... Just from the again from the definition here, we don't have anything like the same numbers here. They're globally unique, so we can't really give them there. And all that we can read off from these dependencies is that, well, the dependencies allow for these things to be concurrent, but it doesn't mean that they always happen in concurrent. So it might be misleading to give them the same numbers. So it's what you can see from these things is a sort of a maybe property. They may be parallel, but they don't. They are not parallel in all cases. So this is the differentiation between the exists or for all quantification in that sense. So yeah, it might be parallel, but it does. It's not necessarily like that. So a happened before relation can help you with a maybe concurrent property. Good. So. Summing up these relations, we can model concurrency using processes and events with happened before relation. between events of each process and between events from different processes. This is a strict partial order, and clock is a total strict order that embeds this happened before order and gives you one particular instance of dependencies that you're given with the happened before relation. So let's continue with that in mind to actual concrete definitions for memory models. So our idea would be now to use these happened before diagrams to talk about memory models that are more relaxed than this very strict consistency. And what is behind that is that we consider a given path through each of the threads of the program. So we at some point fix the problem space of all particular executions that a particular algorithm can do, and consider the actions that each thread of the events of a process triggers, and use the means of these process diagrams with as many process lines as we want precision in our modeling to model what happens in the actual memory. So the model with which we start from is a model where we model each of the variables of our memory as one process line in the memory. And with that, we can represent already some interleavings. So let's establish a model that is called sequential consistency, which is a model that you will meet a lot when you start talking about memory in parallel and concurrent systems. And the original definition of that would be that the result of any execution of the program is the same as if the memory operations of the of each individual processor always appears in the order specified by the program. So within a particular process, you can rely on when you have passed a particular memory access instruction that its effect is then valid for everything that follows this particular instruction. And for all processes and their processes joined with each other, you can the execution is the same as the execution of one particular sequential order of all the instructions that occurred over all processors. So in your global view, you will find that there's a mixture of events from different processes that have to do something with memory occurring. But if you just filter out from this chaotic sequence all the events that belong to just one process, you can still see that the intra-process sequence is still maintained. So within the global view, all the events happen in the way that the local process has specified them. However, they are. This says that it's allowed to interleave each process's events with the events from another process in any way possible, such that the intra-processual sequence is maintained. So this gives rise to a whole lot of different executions that are still okay, since they are some sequential order of the local things, as long as locally their ordering remains the same. So for multiprocessor programs, this means that for a program with n threads, we take each of these threads as a process and fix event sequences. And these are here generically sorted, named with this P0, P1, and so on. And we have to sort them in a way that they keep or maintain program order for each of these threads. And the executions that we set up globally, which of these things are ones that obey the clock conditions. So the sequence that we fix for that can be can be everything that is still obeying to the clock conditions. So there are several sequentialized versions of these events that are available, and if all of these executions have the same result, then we consider the program to be sequentially consistent. So if all the clock conditions that you can set up in that sense have the same result, then this is quite a strong property already. This gives you quite a reliable result in terms of an idea of how memory works. As long as you are able to come up with one sequential version of all your events, such that they are still in program order, of course. And if you if you are able to determine what this the result of this computation then is, in a sequentially consistent system, all of the interleavings that can be constructed will be will have the same result. So, what can we do with something like that? Well, this is a definition which we can use in order to prove, for example, that a particular system is actually not sequentially consistent. So in case that we can find two interleavings of fixed sequences of process events such that they are obeying the clock condition, but yield different results, then we have shown that the system that we have there is not actually sequentially consistent. And what we can do now is we can start modeling our system in terms of a certain idea of how the hardware works and try to model that then with these sequence diagrams and check whether this is a system that is sequentially consistent, because, well, this is quite a convenient result. If you can just find one linearization of our events or sequentialization of our events and know what is the outcome of that, then we have everything. So this is quite a desirable property. And, well, if you can show that this doesn't hold for a particular system, then we might have to redesign that. So The initial diagrams that we had for giving us an intuition of how strong consistency works was the one seen over here, where we had memory modeled with one process and accesses to variables were only sequentially possible. So one idea would be to come up with hardware that supports accessing variables concurrently, so in parallel. So for that, the accesses to memory would not be dependent on each other anymore. So for these systems, we would have to come up with a model that does the accesses to the variable concurrently, and this is only, well, in our world, that's possible by modeling them with two processes for each of, two processes, one for each of the variables. So we split the memory now in two variables, A and B, and we try to observe what happens there. So for our program here, there would be the access to, or the store to variable A happening there, and the store to variable B happening there, with now the events chosen like this. So you were asking about what we choose for events. So we for each of the processes, we have the event of an update to a variable being requested. So this is an atomic thing. You just put that out on the network, and it might terminate after some time, but the actual event of triggering a store to a thing is, in that sense, atomic. The memory itself, at some point, will reflect that change, and for our purposes, access to a single variable is also considered to be atomic on the level of the actual memory. So this is also an event that happens in our world, and only when that has happened, we communicate back to the original process that the change has been done, and this is then used as a trigger for the process to continue working. So this is the way that we distribute or that we map actions in the processes to events in this diagram. And since there's no two events that happen at the same time for the memory, with the model like this, we can only sequentially access variables. And, well, what we have said is that we would like for more concurrency. So we model a system where we can independently access variables, and this can be done by introducing separate lines. And now we can more or less independently access A and B, and since there is no direct happen before relation between those two anymore, they are in that sense concurrent in our happen before relation. So even in this world, as soon as this read from B turns into or returns 1 instead of 0, the subsequent read from A will also yield 1. Why is that? Well, that is because the event of triggering the store to B is happening after the event for the acknowledgement for store of into A has arrived at A. So there is a certain causality between those. So a subsequent read from this thing will yield the updated value from there, because there is a certain causality in this. So this goes through this, 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 and this. So these are, in that sense, the chain of happened before things. Okay, so this is still given in our system. So yeah, even separating these lines now gives us still sequential consistency. So you might now wonder whether there are certain conditions under which sequential consistency is not found anymore. But maybe see, there's another slide in between. So sequential consistency by itself is a thing that you have already said is quite desirable, since this means that there we have a good understanding of how the behavior of a concurrent program is, and we can reason quite well on a sequentially consistent system. Well, as long as we have sequentially consistent systems, programs don't contain any races, and these are these erratic, sporadic errors that you see in concurrent programs that you want to circumvent. So is there actual real hardware that provides a thing like sequential consistency? Well, there is. This is a model that is suitable for processes that have exclusive access to memory, only one at a time. So for those, it's definitely a model that you can find in the wild. And then there is systems out there that are using caches that don't that distribute their representations of memory throughout some complicated hierarchy of memories. However, there is ways of maintaining sequential consistency even for those systems. We'll see how that works. And yeah, in those systems, you can also there are systems that also have sequential consistency, although there is something like a cache. Is there systems that don't have sequential consistency? Well, more hardware development goes on, and in the search for performance, there have been these ideas of dropping certain properties, and one of them is actually sequential consistency. And if you have systems with out-of-order stores, for example, hardware like that will not naturally have any sequential consistency guaranteed anymore, due to complex optimizations in the cache line management. So we will see a little bit later on how these systems work. So first of all, I have said that there is systems with caches that still guarantee you sequential consistency. So let's have a look at one implementation of that. And this is a cache system that has the so-called MESI protocol in there. So this is a way of organizing hierarchical memory systems in a way that they still can guarantee a nice property like sequential consistency. So MESI protocol, what is that? This is for systems with processors that use caches to have a very fast but very limited amount of memory that hides the latency of usual RAM, which is quite big in that sense, for accesses to locations that are frequently used in your program. This happens for a working set of variables that you access several times. It also works for the top of the stack of your program, for example. So there are certain things that you would like to have in the stack. What they do is they keep a local mirror image of certain memory regions. Usually they combine several cells of the memory in one so-called cache line, and this region requires a little bit of bookkeeping, which of the processes actually has a copy of those, since they can be, of course, modified, and since there's a certain latency involved with writing it back to the main memory, other instances of this image might be outdated at some point. So in order to cope with that, there's a certain protocol in place. And the protocol means that we have, for each of the participants, a state machine that we have to manage during the execution of the program. Each of the processes thus has a finite state machine consisting of these states M, E, I, and S for each of the cache lines that it has. And when there is events happening, either triggered locally or from some other actor in the system, there might be a change, a transition in our local finite state machine to a new state, and we have to keep that up to whatever it should be in there. So what are these states M, E, S, and I meaning for each of these cache lines? I is the first state, which means that the cache line associated with this state is conceptually invalid right now. It is not associated with any real line in the memory and is ready for reuse. So this is kind of the initial state in that sense. Then there is the state shared, which means that this contains a valid image of the main memory. And it also indicates that there is another process on another processor that has an identical copy of the same cache line and works with that. So that's that. Then there's E, like exclusive. This is this means that the content is valid and that there is there is no other processor whose cache contains the same cache line. So this cache line is ready to be modified by the process and can overwrite without consulting or synchronizing with any of the other processors. And then there's the modified state, which is usually associated with a cache line that has been modified after it had been exclusively available. And this means that this cache line is still exclusive to that cache and has been modified from the state that it had when it came from memory. So this is a fresh change that we should probably communicate back to either other to other processors or the main memory at some point. So these are the four basic states. Of course, then there's also the rest of the cache line, which contains the actual data, which we talk about, but that is that. So the way that the cache lines are now kept consistent is by sending messages between the cache lines, which might trigger certain state changes, transitions in this final state machine at the other cache line that receives that message, or if it is not relevant to this other processor, that might just change nothing. So what are possible messages in these systems? So there's the concept of a read message. This is sent by a particular processor when it wants to read from a particular address. This can all these messages are given on a shared message bus and can be read from all other participants of the communication, meaning the main memory, the other processors, and that's usually it. Then there's a concept of a message which is a read response. This is can come from either of the other processes in case that its cache line has a representation of the address that is needed to be read in state exclusive or shared. And this is then considered to, as a response to a read message. There also might be an invalidate request message, or short invalidate. This is issued in case that a particular processor already has a valid copy of the data and wants to make sure that this process is the only one who has a copy in order to modify this thing. So in case that a processor has a shared version of a cache line and it wants to make an update to that, it should make sure that no one else has such a copy by invalidating. Invalidate acknowledge is the response to that. This comes from another processor that has received such an invalidate message in order for the original processor to know when it can start considering its copy of the cache line to be exclusive and start rewriting that. You can also combine those two together with a so-called read and validate. This is a read with intention to write, so to say, or read with intention to modify. This is usually issued when you already know that you will want to store, for example, 5 to variable x, but don't haven't read x before. Then you need to issue such a read invalidate. You usually do that because a cache line is not containing just one variable, but several of those. But still, if you want to modify that cache line, you need the complete cache line and not just the space for variable x. And if you want to update just x, you still need the rest that is in this cache line. So you need to issue a read. But you do that with intention to write. Thus, follow-up will be invalidate, and you can combine that in one message so that another process that has this information can hand it to you and immediately drop this thing into invalid state. And, well, at some point, there's also the write-back, which is a particular read response. This is a read response when a state is when a cache line is in state modified and someone else requests information about that. So if there's a read arriving at a processor for an address that is available in its cache line and its state is modified, then it's not enough to just do a read response, because this will lead for the peer to flag this cache line as being shared. However, it's already modified and needs to be written back to memory at some point. So what you do is you answer with a write back. Since the memory is also listening to the shared bus, this will also lead to the memory preparing for an actual update of this cache line in its internal store somewhere. The only thing is that this will probably go into a queue because memory is slow, and at some point it will be put into the actual real hardware memory cell, but that might take a little bit time. But still, as soon as a write back is issued, you will implicitly notify the main memory about a change there, and the main memory will then make sure that this is stored, and from there on you can consider your cache line not being a modified dirty one anymore, but it's canon. Everyone will consider this to be the current value of the memory, and you can share it with your shared state. So this is the messages that are out there, and I think we are out of time today, so I won't do the example right now, but we will next time maybe once again repeat the messages and then dive directly into an example of how this works in order to make sure that your memory is consistent. So thank you for your attention, and hope to see lots of you again. This might be a nice change. So thank you.